Well, good afternoon, everyone, and it is afternoon. My name is Rick Hardy. Some of you know me already, and I'm the director of the Honors College and professor of political science here at Western. And today we celebrate the Constitution Day. Let me mention something about that very briefly. A man by the name of Robert Byrd, he was a U.S. Senator from West Virginia. And in fact, when he retired in 2000, well, actually died in office in 2010, he had the record of serving, had the longest continuous service in the United States Congress, 57 years, 230 days, and 28 minutes. But who's counting? But what we remember him for, from my perspective, is the fact that in 2004, he added to an amendment to an education appropriation bill, a rider, an amendment, at the last minute, the 11th hour, as we say. And that provision stipulated that any institution of education, whether public or private, no matter whether it's elementary school or graduate school, that received even one penny from the federal government was required henceforth to celebrate the Constitution annually on September 17th or within 1 week thereof, or lose all federal funding. Now, there's an incentive for you to participate. And so, once that was established, it is up to each institution to determine exactly how this is to be done. And approximately 8 years ago, then Provost Joe Rollo came to me and to Keith Bauckham and said, well, you guys are in charge, figure out how to do it. And so we started having every year a panel discussion, and then last year we started adding some posters, let the students participate by adding their own aspect or own perspective on the Constitution. So each year thereafter, we have had different themes. We've had themes such as freedom of speech, freedom of religion. We've had search and seizure, women's rights in the Constitution, history of the Constitution. This year's theme, as you well know, is freedom of the press and the Constitution. Now, there are many people that are responsible that I want to acknowledge. First of all, our provost is here. Provost Ken Hawkinson, he's our boss and the academic chief academic officer. And he's been very instrumental in supporting what we do here. So, Provost, thank you for being here. Dean Sue Martinelli Fernandez is in the audience as well. And Sue, thank you for all you do to help promote. And you've been a real supporter of the Honors College and everything we do at Constitution Day. I want to thank Michael Lorenzen. I don't think he is here, but he's the Dean of Libraries. He's been very instrumental in helping us. I also want to thank Patty Battles. I don't know if Patty is here. She always ducks out when I introduce her. For all her help and help put up the posters and the logistics involved in this. Tammy Sales of the library has been, Tammy, wave your hand. She has been very, very helpful and most instrumental in helping us put this together. And so thank you very much. Stefan Nola, one of our graduate students, ambassadors that is, was helpful in putting this together. Laura Caldwell and Sean A. Sullivan, who did our poster, want to thank them. Dr. Kim Rice, who's on our panel, Dr. Bauckham will introduce her in just a moment. Tori Smith, Professor Smith, thank you for your work in putting this together. And thank all the students from the Centennial Scholars who were part of the President's Leadership Class. We want to thank you very much. And the omnipresent, Rich Eggers from Tri-State Radio is here is covering this. So thank you, Rich, for all you do in promoting this. Most of all, I want to thank the students who participated by doing their posters back there. Would you students just raise your hand or stand up or whatever who did this, raise your hand. Let's give them a round of applause. Those are some wonderful posters that students have done either on justices or on the cases that deal with the First Amendment and freedom of the press. September 17th, 1787 is the day that our framers affixed their signature to that document at Federal Hall in Philadelphia. And from that point on, this is why we celebrate on this particular day. The topic, as we mentioned, is freedom of the press. The First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise there or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or of the right to people to peaceably assemble and petition government for redress of grievances. Freedom of the press is a pillar of our freedoms. As Walter Lippmann, a great journalist, once said, freedom of the press is not a privilege, it is an organic necessity of the people of a free society. That is important to understand, but it's more than just books, it's more than magazines, it's more than newspapers. It also could entail movies and television and records and CDs and everything else, and even comedians' jokes. Why? Because they're written down first in a script. So it entails a lot of things, but our framers could never have envisioned what we have today with the advent of radio, television, and most of all, today with the internet and Facebook and everything else. Who knows where we're going? Now, to moderate our group today, I've asked Dr. Keith Bachelman to serve. He is the distinguished professor, a renowned scholar, and a good friend, and the chair of the Political Science Department. Please give a hearty welcome, if you will, to Dr. Keith Bachelman. Keith.
Thank you, Rick. I'll be introducing the panelists today. We have four distinguished panelists, and they will speak in the order that I introduce them. They will each spend about 5 to 10 minutes on their particular topic, and we'll have time at the end for questions. We'll start with Kimberly Rice. She is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science. She came to Western in 2012 after receiving her PhD from the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. Teaches courses on judicial politics and constitutional law, and her research focuses on judicial deference to administrative agencies. Today, she will speak on the First Amendment implications of the WikiLeaks phenomenon. Following Dr. Rice, we'll have Mariah Carencross, who has been an instructional services librarian at Malplass Library for the last year and a half. Before that, she worked as a librarian at the City University of Seattle and received her library science degree from the University of Washington. Mariah began a career as a journalist where she worked for The Stranger and Alternative News Weekly in Seattle, and she will talk about open access to scholarly communication as a freedom of the press issue. Then we'll have Yong Tang, who is an assistant professor of journalism and mass media law in the Department of English and Journalism and has taught at Western since 2011. He received his PhD from Penn State and worked for nearly 15 years as a journalist for The People's Daily, the largest and most prestigious newspaper in the People's Republic of China. His research focuses on mass media law, policy, and freedom of information in international journalism. He will speak today on the First Amendment of the Freedom of Information Act. And then finally, we will have Roger Sadler, who is a professor in the Department of Broadcasting, who came to WIU in 1990. His specialties are in broadcast law, news reporting, audio production, and societal issues in broadcasting. He has worked in broadcasting since 1979 and continues to work in radio and TV during the summers and weekends, including for WQAD and WGM-TV and WJEQ Radio. He will speak today on the issue of cameras in the courtroom and their implications for the First and Sixth Amendments. So please welcome our panel. I have one more thing. Rich Egger has asked the panelists to please speak into the microphone so we can get this recorded on the radio. So please, as you're speaking, make sure you have a microphone that you can speak into.
Okay. Good afternoon. Can you hear me okay? Excellent. Try to lead in. Well, welcome to Constitution Day. I'm excited to get to go first. I wanted to start by just piggybacking off of what Dr. Hardy said about the role of the press in the constitutional scheme. This is something that we discuss in constitutional law classes and in civil liberties and overall in American government and politics. In 1975, in the Hastings Law Review Journal, Potter Stewart begins by quoting Justice Brandeis, and Stewart was also a former justice of the United States Supreme Court. And Brandeis had said that the founders' purpose was not to avoid friction, but by having a means of the inevitable friction incident to the distribution of governmental powers among three departments to save us, the people, now from autocracy. And so that's really the essence or the spirit of the separation of powers and why we set up three branches of government. Justice Stewart goes on in this law review article to say that in the same vein as the three primary branches have been set up under the separation of powers, many of you are familiar with that, and the doctrine of checks and balances, that the primary purpose of the constitutional guarantee of a free press is similar. that in fact the free press could be considered a fourth branch, a fourth institution outside of government that would be an additional check on the three internal or official branches that you find in the Articles of the Constitution. We see a similar philosophy from John Adams when he's writing the words of the Free Press Clause for the Massachusetts Constitution, where Adams says that the liberty of the press is essential to the security of the state. And so we can look at the press and see the press in the relevant cases, if you look back at the posters from the United States Supreme Court, as being a major contributing institution to the preservation of our liberties or our freedoms from improper government intrusion. This becomes especially conflicting or tense when we have issues in times of war. One of the cases that is covered in one of the posters is the New York Times v. U.S. case. These are the Pentagon Papers cases, many of you may be aware. And this is where the New York Times and the Washington Post had an injunction against them by the government. This is sort of the condition of prior restraint or censorship from publishing certain official and confidential documents relating to the Vietnam War. This is a case from 1970 and was decided by the court in 1971, and it really highlights the tensions or the conflicts or the collective dilemmas that result when the group goals or the goals of a group or a governmental institution are in conflict with the goals of the individual. And we see this occur in politics and in political science time and time again. And most of the cases dealing with free press are about the goals or the values or preferences of an individual in conflict with government. Now, we can look at the New York Times v. U.S. case where the court, in a per curiam or by the court decision, ruled in favor of the newspapers and against the government as illustrative for things that might be occurring today with other controversies and scandals. So the extent or the length to which liberty extends, any liberty that's granted by the Bill of Rights, is often up for debate, and the Supreme Court, as the protectors and defenders of the Constitution, are then charged with interpreting the Constitution in such a manner that they see as consistent with the spirit of those amendments. Prior restraint, again, occurs when the government reviews material to determine whether its publication would be allowed in the first place, and that's essentially censorship. Right. We can think of this, as Lee Epstein and Thomas Walker would say, as antithetical to the freedom of press. Right? If anything is the antithesis to the freedom of press, it is censorship. Prior restraint in national security in cases like the New York Times and the United States goes specifically to the heart of this debate over the individual versus the government. And here, the court said in its per curiam opinion that the government could not overcome a heavy presumption against prior restraint or censorship. If we look at Justice Black's concurring opinion with Justice Douglas joining, he said that every moment's continuance of the injunctions against these newspapers amount to a flagrant and indefensible violation of the First Amendment. Justice Black and Douglas, in fact, would not have even held oral arguments on this case. They would have automatically lifted the injunction against the papers. Justice Black as well says that the press is there to serve the governed, meaning us, and not the governors, something that Dr. Hardy alluded to in his introduction as well. But some disagreed. Chief Justice Berger, in his dissent, felt that because this case was so expedited, that they didn't know all of the facts, that perhaps New York Times and Washington Post were going to release things that could endanger a country. Blackman says that the First Amendment is only part of an entire constitution, and that Article 3 of the same great document vests in the executive branch primary power over conduct of foreign affairs, and it is the branch that's responsible for the nation's safety. We see a lot of this same tension playing out now with the WikiLeaks phenomenon. WikiLeaks is a not-for-profit media organization that was started in 2007. and has come under a lot of scrutiny because over the years they have done things that have potentially compromised the safety and other national security goals. Examples include things like WikiLeaks releasing collateral murder packages, documentations, and videos, a video depicting a July 2007 killing of two Reuters journalists, right? The hacking of Sarah Palin's Yahoo email account, right, by WikiLeaks, and the release of that. Posting of 76,000 classified military reports from the war in Afghanistan are something that WikiLeaks has done. And while the founder of WikiLeaks is not a United States citizen, some people that have worked with him are, and some people that have leaked information through WikiLeaks are. And so we're coming now to a head of a controversy over whether the rights and liberties of those individuals, right, are going to be protected by this part or this clause of the First Amendment over the national security interests and the authority vested to the executive branch in Article 3 of the Constitution. For example, Bradley Manning, Private First Class Manning, and Edward Snowden. You may have heard these names in the media recently. Manning has just been sentenced to 35 years in prison for his efforts and publication and revealing of documents and surveillance by the National Security Agency through WikiLeaks. Snowden, as his, many would say, co-conspirator, is also coming under a lot of heat, as is Glenn Greenwald, who's the columnist for The Guardian that has released and written on a lot of these issues. And so it's not just a question of one individual with classified information, but when the press chooses to use that information and publicize it, we see that conflict. Much as we saw it in New York Times v. U.S., we will see it again today with the issue of WikiLeaks. And so the question I would leave you all with when you think about this controversy, when you think about how to address the freedom of press clause of the First Amendment, is to understand that we are in an increasingly competitive political environment, and we are in a political environment now with a 24-hour news cycle that can oftentimes be less than accurate or less than complete in the ways in which the media and those reporting for the media will pursue a particular story. And so this is something I'm sure all of us caution our students against, right? Believing just little sound bites. And so we're going to have to decide in this increasingly competitive political environment, and in an environment where information is so free and so universal and so accessible at any moment and at the touch of a fingertip, how that is going to affect our understanding, our interpretation, and our belief in this particular clause. Will it be the same as it was in New York Times v. U.S.? Will we continue to see the press as being there for the governed and not for the governors? Thank you.
Okay, can you hear me? All right, my name is Mariah Carncross, and I should warn you right off the bat, I am in no way a constitutional scholar. So this is going to be kind of like the Freedom of the Press for Dummies edition. But okay, so I started my career as a journalist at The Stranger in Seattle. And in that part of my career, I never actually really thought too much about the freedom of the press. Nothing that I ever wrote, and to my knowledge, none of what my colleagues ever wrote was ever under fire. It was never under threat of censorship. As a librarian, though, my definition of what press really is has sort of expanded to encompass all different kinds of information, including and especially scholarly communications. So oftentimes, I think, when we think of freedom of the press in terms of the First Amendment, we think of journalism, right? We think of newspapers, magazines, media. But in fact, the Supreme Court has defined press as every sort of publication which affords a vehicle of information and opinion. And because I work in an academic library, I work primarily in the realm of scholarly communications. And so I'd like to talk for a few minutes today about the idea of open access to those scholarly communications being a freedom of the press issue. Now, since many of you in the audience are scholars in some capacity, some of you are professors, some of you are students, I'm hoping that this will be of interest to you as well. So first, a little background about the cereals crisis. Basically, major academic publishers have created within the past 10 to 15 years a situation where most academic universities can no longer afford to purchase or provide access to the essential publications, the scholarly materials that they once were able to. And this is happening while publishers are reaping enormous profits. Many of the journals have as much as doubled in price over recent years, and this is greatly outpacing general inflation. In 2012, the Faculty Advisory Council at Harvard University issued a memo recognizing the unfortunate state of academic publishing. This council reached the following conclusion. Major periodical subscriptions, especially to electronic journals published by historically key providers, cannot be sustained. Continuing these subscriptions on their current footing is financially untenable. Doing so would seriously erode collection efforts in many other areas already compromised. So Harvard has recognized this, and this situation is affecting us at Western as well. So many of the individual journals that you guys access, you know, every day through our databases and here at the library cost thousands of dollars per subscription. And many of the database packages that we purchase can cost thousands of dollars and even tens of thousands of dollars. And in light of our recent budget cuts, we're not able to purchase the essential materials that we once were able to. So what's the effect of that? Scholars, students, and professors simply don't have as ready and as much access as we once did. So some of you may be asking, why do scholars choose to contribute to this model? If this is such an untenable model, why do we keep publishing in these journals? One is the reputation of the journals. Oftentimes, for professors and scholars, the only way to publish in a top-tier, first-rate journal is to go through the traditional academic press. And scholars, as many of you know, need to do this in order to keep their jobs in most cases, in order to get tenure. And if scholars do want to make their works freely available for students and kind of work around this model, oftentimes they have to pay a hefty price out of pocket to do so. And so the bottom line is that information is not as freely available as it should be to those who need it. So a couple of responses to this situation. The first is making do with less, which is what universities all over the country, including Western, are doing. We're working with the various academic departments to cut current periodical subscriptions and try to make do with what we have. Another response, and these are not mutually exclusive, but another response is the open access movement. Scholars have been working within the past 10 or so years to create forums for free access and free dissemination of scholarly communications. And this movement has gained quite a bit of traction, although its level of perceived legitimacy really depends on the discipline that you're working with and also the individual institution. So there were some early manifestos and initiatives that sort of started in the early 2000s, the first being the Budapest Open Access Initiative, which was drafted in 2001. And the language of that reads, the new goal is that within the next 10 years, open access will become the default method for distributing new peer-reviewed research in every field in country. Well, here we are 12 years later, and that has not come to fruition, although it could be trending that way. There are some other manifestos and statements, the Bethesda Statement, the Berlin Declaration, and these are all scholars in the sciences and humanities, which have sort of said enough and drafted statements to that effect. Now, as I mentioned, some progress has been made towards fulfilling the tenets of some of these manifestos. Organizations like the Creative Commons, I don't know if you guys have heard of that, but they allow authors to specify exactly what rights they want to retain and what they want to waive as regards their own work. But this sort of assumes that authors are self-publishing or publishing in a way that they are able to determine exactly what rights they want to withhold and give away. And that's definitely not the case when working with major academic publishers. A couple of the basic models of open access. The gold model is open access journals. These are publications that are either completely free for users to access and authors to publish in, or they're journals where some content, select amounts of information, are made available online. And oftentimes, as I was mentioning, the authors do have to pay a publication fee to participate in this model. The other is the green model, and this is the self-archiving model. So under this framework, an author would retain some of the rights to his or her own work. They would still publish within a traditional academic scholarly journal, but they would retain a copy, usually a manuscript copy, of their work and publish it within the institution in some kind of repository or database created and maintained by the university. And sometimes these manuscripts are called gray literature, and again, the level of legitimacy of these documents really depend on the discipline you're working with in the institution. So as I mentioned, in terms of scholarly acceptance, it just depends a lot on the discipline you're working in and the institution you work for. The federal government does seem to be accepting the open access movement. Recently, John Holdren from the Office of Science and Technology Policy issued a memo that required all federal agencies that had over $100 million in research and development funding to make a copy of their research freely available and searchable to the general public. So that sets kind of a strong precedent for open access in the government. However, there are some complications. One, predatory journals. There are some publishers that sort of unscrupulously take manuscripts from authors and publish them without any sort of peer review or vetting process, often charging a really hefty fee for authors to publish at the same time. And so, you know, sometimes it's hard to tell whether or not these journals are legitimate or whether they're predatory, and that can be really, you know, a hot issue for scholars. Also, the gold model of open access, as I mentioned, can be very expensive. I mean, if we're using open access to try to get around this model of extreme cost, having to pay thousands of dollars to submit your manuscript to an open access journal doesn't really make a lot of sense. So I've described this issue, right, this open access issue, but you're probably wondering at this point, okay, what does it have to do with the First Amendment? How is this a First Amendment issue? Well, freedom of the press allows for people to express themselves through written word without interference from the federal government. And freedom of the press in the U.S. is thought to mean prohibiting the government from interference of publishing, disseminating, distributing information. And you could argue that these recent efforts by the federal government, John Holdren, to provide unrestricted access to federally funded scholarly publications is a way of sort of recognizing authors' First Amendment rights and helping facilitate dissemination and access and making sure they're not standing in the way of these authors' publication and dissemination of their work. But in the case of the cereals crisis, the government isn't really the body that's prohibiting access to information. It's the academic publishers. And publishers, by the letter of the First Amendment, are not restricted in any way from charging exorbitant amounts for their products. So, and in fact, actually, most of the worldwide freedom of the press, freedom of information laws don't make any provision for private corporations like publishers. Usually their jurisdiction is just the government. But this is really problematic because private publishers control the flow of information in our modern society. It's not really the government, and especially this is true in the area of scholarly communications. So even though this control isn't prohibited explicitly by the letter of the Constitution, you could argue that there's a tension between sort of the spirit of the Constitution and the idea of access to information and to publish one's own works and the letter of the law, which sort of grants the publishers certain rights. So as time goes on, though, I believe we will see a dismantling of the traditional publishing structure, and open access will be seen as more legitimate and will gain more traction. And hopefully that will be some solution to the cereals crisis. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. My name is Yong Tang. I'm from English and Journalism Department. Happy Constitution Day. So more than 200 years ago, our founding fathers signed this very important document. It is this document which makes America unique and strong. Unlike in my country, where almost nobody takes the Constitution very seriously, to be frank. So today, I'm going to talk about the First Amendment, especially the Free Press and Speech Clause and the Freedom of Information Act. So what is the First Amendment? The Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. So everybody knows that, right? Freedom of Information Act. So what is that? It's a federal statute that was signed into law by U.S. President Johnson in 1966. And it became effective in 1967. According to this law, any U.S. citizen or anyone in the world even can apply for a copy of any document or records held by U.S. federal agency. So this is cool, right? So as long as those kind of information does not fall into those nine exemptions, so the federal government has a legal obligation to disclose. So what is the relationship between the First Amendment and the Freedom of Information Act? So everybody knows that we have very strong privacy protections in this country, right? And the right to privacy is a constitutional right in this country. But unfortunately, in this in America, right of access to information or right to know, in other words, is not a constitutional right. So far, there are over 60 countries that has adopted a freedom of information concept, either implicitly or explicitly in their constitutions. So America is an unfortunate exception here. Over the last 70 years, the U.S. Supreme Court has decided a number of freedom of information related cases. In those cases, only there is one case that has granted the public a right of access. What is that case? Richmond Newspapers versus Virginia, which was decided in 1998. So according to this case, the U.S. government, a U.S. general public has a First Amendment protected right of access to attend criminal trials. So that's the only encouraging case. So all the other cases have turned down the notion of a constitutionally protected right of access. For example, there are three cases that are very famous. Pell versus Procuneer, decided in 1974. Saxby versus Washington Post, decided in 1974. Hutchinson's versus QQED, decided in 1978. In those three cases, reporters tried to request an interview with the prisoner. They want to examine if the terrible prison conditions led to the death of a prisoner. However, the prison authority rejected the reporter's request, and the rejection was supported by the Supreme Court. So those three cases served as a very important legal precedent denying the constitutional right of access to government institutions and government-held documents and records. So today we have only a First Amendment right to attend criminal trials. That's it. So what's the point? Should our freedom of information have constitutional status, like the right to privacy? A lot of people said yes, a lot of people said no. Yes, person, they argue that without freedom of information, freedom of speech is meaningless. Without freedom of information, freedom of the press becomes meaningless. Why? Because in order for citizens to know when and how to criticize their government, they must know beforehand what their government is doing, right? Low persons, they argue that freedom of information is a positive right. It's not a negative right. So what's the difference between negative right and positive right? Negative right basically is something like, please keep away from my life. The government should not do anything to interrupt me. That's a negative right. Positive right means the government should do something to protect me or to promote some kind of rights. And all the rights, they argue, no person argued that all rights embodied in the First Amendment and even in the Constitution belong to a negative right. So freedom of information is clearly a positive right. So they can't grant freedom of information a constitutional status. Also, the Supreme Court has a tendency to be deferent to the executive branch of our federal government, especially after 9/11, after the terrorist attacks of 9/11. So judicial branch becomes more and more deterrent to the executive branch. So they're becoming less and less willing to accept the argument that we should have a First Amendment right of access to government documents. So what is my argument? Here's my point. Freedom of information or legal right of access should be afforded constitutional protection. In other words, freedom of information should become one part of our First Amendment right. Without such a First Amendment protection, our Freedom of Information Act system is becoming breaking down. It becomes toothless. Just like what happened during the George W. Bush's administration. So I want to quote, finally, a dissenting opinion by Justice Stevens and Justice Brennan and Paul in Hutchinson versus QQED. Just as I mentioned, in this case, two reporters request an interview with a prisoner. So they just want to examine what happened in the prison. However, their request was rejected by the Supreme Court. And Justice Stevens and Justice Brennan and Justice Powell, they said no. They said we should grant such a request. They said, quote, there is no legitimate penological justification for concealing from citizens the conditions in which their fellow citizens are being confined in the prison. And an official prison policy of concealing such knowledge from the public by arbitrarily cutting off the flow of information at its source abridges the freedom of speech and of the press protected by the First and 14th Amendments to the Constitution. Thank you.
Trying to get this fly. Okay. My name is Roger Sadler again from the Department of Broadcasting. Can you hear me pretty well? Okay. What I want to talk about briefly here is the combination of the First and Sixth Amendments. Okay, you guys, the Sixth Amendment, the accused shall have the right to a what? Anybody?
Speedy trial.
Yeah, a fair, speedy, and public trial. Speedy, we don't tend to follow that too much anymore. That tends to be kind of a nefarious term. Nobody really can define it anymore. We have trials delayed for years. A public trial, what does that involve? Why did the founders want a public trial? Why is that? Anybody? I'll let you chime in. Why do we want our courts open? Well, we don't want them secretive. We want to make sure that the trial process is open to the public. Well, does that include cameras? Because I guarantee you they didn't have cameras, 230 years ago. How many of you have watched a trial on TV lately? Okay, what, George Zimmerman, perhaps? Okay, how about the Jody Arias trial, which I was a little sick of seeing? Okay, you didn't see those things 30 years ago for the most part. Most trials weren't on television. Why? Give you a little bit of a history here. Charles Lindbergh, famous hero, what was he known for? What did he do? Yeah, I think actually just across the Atlantic. He flew solo across the Atlantic. That's okay. A little bit of history there. So he was a national hero back in the late 20s, early 30s. A man named Bruno Hauptmann broke into his home late at night and kidnapped his infant son and killed him. So you have the infant son of a national hero being killed. Well, you can imagine what the trial was like. Okay, everybody wanted to know about it, and the judge allowed cameras and reporters, still cameras, into the trial, and it created a circus atmosphere. Bruno Hauptmann was found guilty of killing Lindbergh's baby, but a lot of people thought he didn't get a fair trial because of the media coverage, because the media were basically, I don't know, kind of like they were maybe with Jodi Arias, kind of convicting her before she was found guilty. I mean, they were all basically saying she's guilty, come on. So Canon 35 came out from the American Bar Association. They said, you know what? Cameras in the courtroom inherently detract from the dignity of the courtroom and affect not only the jury members and the judge and the lawyers, but the public as well in terms of how they're going to look at a trial. So that was kind of the policy that was followed for decades. Most judges, most courts did not allow cameras in the courtroom because they found them intrusive. There was a case back in Texas, Estes versus Texas, back in the 1960s, where the judge allowed the cameras in the courtroom involving a state official in Texas. A big film camera. Anybody ever seen the old film cameras? They're pretty big and bulky. They require a lot of cables, a lot of wires, a lot of lights, technicians. So with that camera set up in the courtroom, kind of chaotic. Lots of noise and everything. Well, the guy was found guilty. He appealed it to the U.S. Supreme Court saying, you know what? I didn't get a fair trial because of that stupid camera. And the Supreme Court agreed. They ruled 5-4 that just the presence of the camera detracted from him getting a fair trial because so many people in the room were focused on the camera. But they said if camera technology changes down the road where cameras aren't intrusive like that, maybe we'll change our minds. That came about in the late 1970s with Chandler versus Florida, where the state of Florida allowed cameras in the courtroom on a trial basis for two police officers who were accused of breaking and entering. And I think they made the mistake of talking about their crime on walkie-talkies and people picked it up. Okay, so they weren't bright police officers. But anyway, during the trial, they thought, well, having these cameras here, this affected us. We feel that we were found guilty simply because of the presence of the cameras. The Supreme Court ruled in Chandler versus Florida, you know what? We're going to allow cameras to be determined in the courtrooms by the states. And the states can pass laws whether or not they want to have cameras in the courtroom. And that's how it's working today. Anybody know what the situation is currently in Illinois? How are we doing with cameras in the court? Up until the last couple of years, I mean, we pretty much have not allowed cameras in the court except at the highest appellate level. Now we're on a trial basis where we're allowing them into lower level courts. What do you think are some of the problems? What would you imagine having a camera in the courtroom creates for jury members? If you're a jury member, why might you be worried about a camera? Anybody? Well, let me give you a Shepard versus Maxwell back in the 1960s. Anybody ever seen the old movie, The Fugitive, the old TV show? No? Okay. It's about a guy named Sam Shepard. He was a doctor. Now, see if you buy this story. He said that he was in his home, asleep on the couch. He heard his wife scream upstairs. He ran up the stairs, and some guy attacked him and knocked him unconscious. Police come later, find his wife dead. Oh, wait a minute. Your wife is dead. The attacker killed her, but he didn't kill you. We're a little suspicious of this. The media were suspicious of that story as well. The judge allowed cameras, reporters, everything in the courtroom, and he allowed a local newspaper to publish the names and phone numbers of the jury members. A little bit of a problem. Guess what happened? The public started calling the jury members and saying, "Vote guilty! We don't buy his story." And the media didn't buy his story either. He was found guilty by the jury. He appealed that. The Supreme Court ruled that because of the media coverage in that trial, we're throwing out the verdict. And he was retried and found not guilty. So cameras can have a detrimental effect on how people behave. Imagine if you're a lawyer in the courtroom and there's a camera there and it's being broadcast live on CNN or Fox or MSNBC on court TV or whatever, True TV now, I guess. Isn't that going to affect how you're going to behave? Aren't you going to behave differently in front of a courtroom, just in front of people, as opposed to in front of a camera where you might be seen by millions? And that's where the conflict comes in. A lot of judges don't like cameras in the courtroom because they think it affects how the lawyers behave, how the jury might vote. The O.J. Simpson trial, that was 18 years ago now. But that got heavy media coverage. CNN got some of its highest ratings ever because people were tuning in to watch it. And it was just kind of a national spectacle. If you were a jury member, you're a black jury member. Are you going to want to vote guilty for O.J. Simpson when your identity is known? Maybe not. Okay, does that put pressure on people in terms of how they're going to vote as a jury member? And they've done studies where they found lawyers tend to ham it up a little bit more when they know cameras are present, and especially if they're on national TV, they're going to act differently. So we, as media people, we like to have cameras in the courtroom so we can capture it, so we can see what's going on. The public likes to see it as well. It's very educational. But there are some drawbacks to it because the presence of the cameras can really affect how people behave in the courtroom, and it can affect sometimes the outcome of the trial people feel. So, in the end, here in Illinois, we're one of the states that is now finally allowing cameras in the courtroom. A lot of media people are happy about that. But you'll be in some states where cameras are not allowed, especially in trial courts, because judges still feel kind of like back to Canon 35 in the 1930s. Just the presence of cameras, like Chris Lovingood over here, just the presence of a camera affects how people behave. And it really can affect how the trial comes out. So that's my brief wrap-up of that. I want to keep this brief because we're running maybe a little over time. So we'll just leave it open to questions, I guess. All right, thank you.